Lear had no interest in me. Still, it seemed like I'd be sending a complicated message if I didn't go. I didn't want to come off like I thought I was too good for Edmonds. So Chris and our son Jack and I took a weekend trip back home. It was 2014. Guardians of the Galaxy had just come out, and Chris was at the beginning of megastardom. I told him that I didn't want to subject him to my reunion, which was true, but I also didn't want the story to be that Anna showed up with Chris. We decided I'd attend alone, and he'd pick me up at the end. All those years later, the idea that I would come in and command any type of narrative still made me anxious. High school reunions are strange that way. They tap into so much: who we were, who we become, who we want to be, and how we want to be perceived. So while intellectually I knew that plenty had changed in those 20 years, once I stepped into the school, it didn't feel that way. I was still awkward and uncomfortable and without any good friends, and the mean girls were still huddled in the corner, and they still seemed pretty mean. This is where you might be picturing Romy and Michelle. You might think that I swooped in and wowed the crowd with how fabulous I'd become in the decade since graduation. You would be wrong. It's true that fame and success have given me more value to some people who otherwise might not want to talk to me. There were a couple of former classmates I chatted with who perhaps wouldn't have been interested if I hadn't made it in Hollywood, and honestly, I was surprised but pleased by how little satisfaction I got from that. Because while that satisfaction might have been human, it might also have made me a giant asshole. The truth of the evening was that there was no "I showed them." I was not the belle of the ball. Mostly I was snubbed. The same girls who were mean to me when I was 18 were whispering about me at 38. But there was something almost comforting in that. Not the talking about me so much as the simple knowledge that some things don't change. Mean girls stay mean. I was perversely happy about it. There was one person at the reunion who I was looking forward to seeing: my old friend Matt. We had been close in high school. I'd had a big crush on him, and of course he knew it. At the reunion, we caught up, and he introduced me to his stunning wife, who was lovely, and then he turned to me and said, "I just want to apologize for being so mean to you." I knew what he was talking about. Junior year, Matt recorded me talking shit about our mutual friend Jeff. Then he played it for Jeff just to make me look like a bitch. I had this theory that we all need to publicize the list of suspects who should be investigated in the event of our murder. If I turn up dead, definitely find out what Jeff was up to. But when Matt apologized all those years later, it was insulting. Of course, I remember how he betrayed me with that recording, and it definitely caused a clear shift in our friendship, but I'd been so excited to see him, and there was so much funny shit he could have referenced from our past instead. It had been 20 years. I was over it. Maybe. Part of the reason you go to a high school reunion, I think, is to get confirmation that the other people remember you as you remember yourself. That night, when former classmates said they recalled me being quiet in high school, it was such a relief, because that's what I remember too. So Matt's apology didn't feel long overdue or make me feel in any way vindicated. It just stung. That's what he remembered? I thought this was someone I had really connected with, and I'd been so eager to see him. The idea that I was reduced to this one moment where he treated me like shit was kind of humiliating. I have this image of Matt and his wife driving to the reunion together and him saying, "Yeah, I was really mean to Anna, so I'm gonna apologize tonight," which I know might be said with the best intentions, but just feels gross. After that interaction, I was done. I had been at the reunion for all of 1 hour, but it was long enough for me to feel like I was in high school again and to be ready to get out. I mean, Green Day was pumping through the loudspeakers. Chris drove down and picked me up, as we'd planned, and it did feel a bit like the lion rescuing the lioness from the hyenas. It was amazing to watch the reaction as he came through the door. I still felt like the headgear-wearing, awkward Anna Faris, but when Chris came in, he was all movie star. There was a collective gasp as he whisked me away, and yes, that was fairly satisfying, I guess. I'm human, after all. It took me longer than it should have to realize just how important female relationships are in my life. That shift only happened fairly recently, maybe in the last 3 to 5 years. It takes vulnerability of spirit to open yourself up to other women in a way that isn't competitive, and that's especially hard in Hollywood, where competition is built into almost every interaction. Female actresses don't get to work together very often, so we truly don't have a ton of face time with one another, though I do like to think that's changing. With guys, like Chris and Seth Rogen and James Franco, they're all buddies and do each other favors and appear in each other's projects. And of course, plenty of women do that too, but sometimes I'm envious of the communities that male actors can establish merely because there have been historically more roles for men in any given project, so they have more opportunities to forge relationships. I have it on my to-do list to host a monthly boozy brunch with a bunch of actresses and no agenda so we can just hang out. Right now, the only times we see one another are at these crazy, high-pressure Hollywood events where you're all wearing gowns and one of you, not me, but the person I'm talking to, is nominated, so she's distracted and freaked out and in no mood to get into girl talk. Like Emma Stone or Jessica Chastain or Amy Adams, all those stunning women who I never see until the award shows, at which they are, rightly, being celebrated, and I'm busy loading up on champagne-infused complimentary snacks. But between filming a sitcom and recording a podcast and raising a five-year-old, I bump up against a lot of the same internal struggles that most working moms do. As much as I want to host my boozy brunch, making time for it in my schedule hasn't been a priority. I can hardly keep up with the friends I already have. My oldest pals constantly give me a hard time for being so bad at texting them back, but that's because I don't want to have a texty relationship. I want to spend an hour talking and getting into the good stuff. I don't have a lot of patience for small talk. I don't even like the phrase. Why would I want to engage in conversation that people deem small? But that means I don't text back or pick up a call until I have the time to devote to that person, which often results in "Are you mad at me?" texts, which just makes me want to put off a call even more because I know the first 20 minutes will consist of apologies instead of conversation. I've heard the suggestion that I don't need a tight group of girlfriends anyway because your partner should be your best friend. But I've never bought that. The idea that your mate must be your best friend feels to me like an overused mantra that puts unnecessary pressure on your relationship. I really believe that your partner serves one purpose and each friend serves another. There's the friend who you confess things to and the friend with whom you do the listening, or this is the person I talk to when I'm feeling lonely and sad, and this is the person I talk to about work shit, and this is the friend I'm still in touch with because we grew up together. To be honest, I think the notion of best friends in general is messed up. It puts so much pressure on any one person, when I truly believe it's okay to have intimacy with different people in different ways. That's why I'm so glad I never had bridesmaids. It seems like a tradition entirely engineered toward forcing you to rank your friends, and that really bothers me. It just shouldn't happen, at least not beyond grade school. Today, I'm lucky to have a handful of women I count as my confidants. Allison Janney, my co-star on Mom, my friend Alex, who I met when we worked on The Hot Chick together, Megan, the friend who got out of Edmonds and writes in New York, and Kate, a dear childhood friend and neighbor who, on paper, I have nothing in common with anymore, at least not from an outsider's perspective, but who totally gets me because history. 6 months ago, I called her and said, "Kate, I was reading this article and I think I have this condition called prosopagnosia, where you are totally face blind and don't recognize people that you've seen before." "Oh God, you totally have that," she said. "Remember that time at the park when you thought your mom was walking across the field and it was really that homeless guy?" Confirming that I might actually have prosopagnosia instead of just saying I was crazy might be the kindest thing she ever did for me. Losing my virginity and other horrible sexual escapades. I had my first kiss when I was 16 and lost my virginity when I was 17. It was a busy couple of years. The kiss was during my junior year of high school. It was a Friday night, and we had just finished a production of You Can't Take It With You, a Pulitzer Prize-winning play in which I played Essie Carmichael. It was a juicy part. Not the lead, but a good meaty role that allowed me to show off my acting chops. I love beef references, dear listener. After our performance, some of the seniors in the cast rented a hotel room in downtown Seattle. I told my parents that I was spending the night at my friend Stephanie's. Yes, Stephanie was also my alibi during the Stone Temple Pilots concert where Chad and I first hooked up. Staying at Stephanie's was a recurring theme of my teenage years. But instead, I went to the hotel room and got wasted. It was my first time being drunk, and Kyle, a senior, held my hair back while I vomited, which anybody who has ever been a drunk girl in high school knows is both disgusting and the epitome of romance all at the same time. After I was done puking, we crawled into a bed where Jeff, the same Jeff who I mentioned might murder me, was already passed out. He was lying on the right side of the bed, Kyle was in the middle, and I was on the left. I don't know how Kyle could stand kissing me after I vomited, but we made out a little bit and he fingered me right there in that king-size hotel bed for three. In hindsight, maybe Jeff is right to want to murder me. I had a minor crush on Kyle. He had a huge grin, big dimples, great hair. He was the kind of guy who seemed stoned all the time, but I don't think he actually was. The fact that he was able to look past my braces and stinky vomit breath and stick his tongue down my throat was a true gift, even if it did feel like there was a slug in my mouth and I had no idea what I was supposed to do. Aggressively kiss him back? Passively receive the kiss? I wasn't sure. To be fair, I'm still not sure I know how to kiss properly. I always wonder if I'm doing it right. Even though I'm an actress and kiss people in movies all the time, you can't exactly ask, can you? And even though those are technically first kisses, I also think about the rush of a real first kiss and wish I could have that without all the teenage awkwardness. That night at the hotel was an evening of firsts. My first makeout session, my first finger bang, my first night in a king-size bed. I was in heaven. So much so that I couldn't wait to write all about it in my diary. I made out and was penetrated. Life is grand. The next morning, I went home first thing because I was scheduled to take my driver's test. My parents, the sweet, supportive people they are, were raving about my performance in the play, while all I could think was, I hope they don't smell the vomit and cigarette smoke. Somehow, I passed my driver's test. It was a major 24 hours in my life. But the blissful high of making out and having a license was short-lived. A few days later, my mother found my diary. She read my recap of Kyle's finger banging and thought it meant I lost my virginity, and she was furious. Here's the thing about my mother. She wanted me to stay a virgin until I was married. She made that very clear. This always confused me because my mom is not a religious person. If her views had been based on God or the Bible, I would have at least understood the root. But she was a steadfast feminist, so her message seemed complicated. I think it was instilled in her at an early age that as a woman, your sexuality was a dangerous and powerful tool, which had to be used extremely carefully. It must have been complicated because she and her sisters were, and are, unbelievably gorgeous women with incredible figures. Growing up, they were dirt poor, but were known as the local hotties, and each of them reacted very differently to the power that comes with being unbelievably attractive. And I'm not saying this just because she's my mom. She's really a knockout. I have these beautiful pictures of her framed in my kitchen, one taken when she was 19 and the other when she was 27. At a far glance, it looks like me, but when you get closer, you see that she had everything I don't. A 70s Playboy bunny look, soft hair, high cheekbones, full lips. She must have really struggled with the complicated power of feeling beautiful and the desire to be desired and the guilt she felt toward anything sexual at all. Anna, you just don't know your own value, my mother said after she read my diary. I didn't get it. I was supposed to be an independent woman, but at the same time, I wasn't supposed to do what I wanted with my body. It didn't make sense. Needless to say, when my mom read about my night with Kyle, she was pissed. And I was too. I was devastated that she would look at my private journal, and it was clear she didn't even understand what she had read. I didn't have sex that night, obviously, and it hurt me that my mom couldn't tell that I was really quite protective of my body, something I thought she should understand just by knowing me. Let's be honest. I could have had sex any time I wanted because I was a 16-year-old girl surrounded by 16-year-old boys, and 16-year-old boys just want a bone. So I did what any teenager angry at her mother would do and threatened to move out. To Stephanie's house, of course. A word about Stephanie. We became friends through drama class. I was a D-plus on the social level, but she was a solid B. Not super glamorous, but very well-liked. She was in drama, though, and that hurt her A. Where I went to high school, doing drama was sort of social suicide. Stephanie had an International Harvester Scout, an old car that was, once upon a time, an alternative to a Jeep. Hers was white and blue, and we used to drive around Edmonds in that truck listening to New Order, and it was awesome. She also had a lot of independence. Her parents were kind of hands-off, so I thought it made perfect sense for me to take a break from my parents and move in with her after the diary fiasco. My mother said no. Of course she did. She was a rational parent. But at the time, I was completely horrified that she wouldn't support the move in light of her betrayal. Nothing else came of that kiss with Kyle. It was fun and kind of gross, and we never hooked up again. But that was okay, because Chad Burke came along soon after that. On November 19th, 1993, I told my parents I was headed to, surprise, Stephanie's house. It was my senior year, and I was about a month into dating Chad. He was friends with some guys who were in a fraternity at UW, so we drove to the campus to crash one of their parties. We were in the frat house, deep into our red solo cups of jungle juice, and suddenly Chad grabbed my hands, looked into my eyes, and said, "Anna, I want you to lose your virginity to me." "Okay, Chad," I said solemnly. "Me too." Chad couldn't say he wanted us to lose our virginity together because it was going to be a second time. He slept with another girl in our high school before he and I got together. I can't remember her name, only that she looked like Ani DeFranco. But they were never in a relationship. I found his honesty about this romantic. My standards were always exceedingly high. I told Chad I wanted to wait until after I turned 17. I don't know why that age marker was important to me, but my birthday was 10 days later, so I figured we wouldn't have to wait much longer. After that, I told him I wanted to do it. The plan didn't quite pan out. I turned 17 on November 29th, and a few days later, before Chad and I had the chance to have sex, I started hemorrhaging out of my vagina. It started out as what my mom told me was my first very heavy period. I had to change my pad every 30 minutes, and it seemed more intense than a period, but what did I know? I was only 17. As an early Christmas present, Chad took me to see Phantom of the Opera, and I had to keep running to the bathroom and begging people for tampons because I'd used up all of mine. Eventually, I bled through my dress, and Chad took me home. My mom told me to take a bath, and we watched as the tub filled up with blood. Later that night, we went to the hospital, and I passed out in the waiting room. It turned out I was having some crazy hemorrhaging where I lost about 50% of my blood in 3 days. I had a cyst on my right ovary, the particularly gnarly kind that has hair and teeth and is just incredibly gross. So I ended up staying in the hospital for about a week, which is, oddly enough, an incredibly happy memory for me because I really hated high school. The doctor I saw during that ordeal became my gynecologist, and at some point I had the opportunity to tell her that I really wanted to have sex with my boyfriend and that, one, my mom couldn't know, and two, I could not get pregnant. So she put me on birth control, which she told my mother was to better regulate my cycle. By January, I was a new healthy woman, and a woman on birth control, no less. Senior year, we were allowed to leave school during lunchtime, and Chad's parents both worked, so on January 7th, I told him I wanted to lose my virginity during lunch. So that's what we did. And it was horrible. No, it wasn't really horrible. It was a solid C. I certainly didn't come, but nobody comes their first time. At that point in my life, I had never masturbated. I had never even explored, so I had no help to offer Chad in terms of getting me off, but I wasn't really in it for the sexual pleasure. I was just head over heels for this guy, and at the time I thought if I was going to keep a man, I had to give him my pussy over lunchtime at his parents' house. In retrospect, his mother must have known. We were totally inconsiderate and never even thought about changing the sheets. Poor Mrs. Burke. After we had sex, Chad and I went back to school, and I felt the weird, illogical pride of having lost my virginity. That afternoon, I went to my neighbor Kate's house. She went to a rival high school and was incredibly hot and popular and was the head of the dance team and had a great laugh and stunning smile and was funny and charming and had lost her virginity long before me. And her mom looked at me and said, "Something looks different about you. You lost your virginity." I know that sounds like something Amy Poehler said in Mean Girls, but she really did say that, and I loved the confirmation that I suddenly seemed more adult. Of course, it took me many more years of sex before I felt any confidence or comfort when it came to doing it. If it hadn't been for my massive insecurity about my body, I probably would have been incredibly promiscuous. I was totally intoxicated with the idea of feeling like a sexual being, and I wanted men to want me. But I was also completely ashamed of my body, especially my boobs, or lack thereof, and insecure about my abilities as a lover. I never felt like the hot girl, even though I so badly wanted to. I felt like I wasn't good enough, and that I didn't know what I was doing when it came to sex or going down on a guy. And when I did get intimate, I was so busy thinking about my own performance that I couldn't appreciate the guys, and it's really hard to have an orgasm when you can't let that part of your brain go. I've grown out of that, thank God, but it took me a long time to get there. Today, I love being intimate with my partner, but I have a lot of trouble being intimate with myself. For a while, in my late teens, on the other hand, I was just the opposite. Freshman year of college, I went through a crazy masturbation phase. We had this college newspaper with an advice column, and one time a reader wrote in and said, "My roommate masturbates all the time. What am I supposed to do about it?" I read it and thought, "Oh man, she's talking about me." To this day, I'm pretty sure I'm right about that, and that the letter was indeed about me. My roommate, Melissa, had a boyfriend who would call our room while she was at work and ask me about masturbating, so I'm convinced she said to him, "Oh God, I'm rooming with this gross girl, Anna, and she gets herself off all the time." Melissa didn't like me very much. Considering that last paragraph, maybe that's not a huge surprise. We had one of those communal shower situations in our dorm bathroom, and one time she came in and started throwing her shampoo and conditioner at me because she was mad that I didn't wake her up for an exam. I was so confused, and still am, because I didn't know that was my responsibility. I ended up leaving that dorm, not because of my excessive masturbation, but because Melissa and I clearly didn't get along, and I moved into a different dorm with a sweet roommate who at one point asked me why they called a blowjob. "I don't know," I said. "Because you blow?" "That's totally incorrect, of course. It's actually because a guy blows his load into your mouth and not about us at all." Big surprise. I got it out of my system, and I have an irrational fear that someone is watching me whenever I'm intimate with myself. I know that's ridiculous, but it's hard to shut off all the insanity that's going on in my brain at any given time. I feel like getting myself off would force me to confront the things that terrify me about myself and to face sexual desires I don't even know I have. Masturbation acknowledges your sexuality in a way that we never did in my household. And while it was easy to get stoned in college and block out those childhood messages, as an adult, I find it surprisingly difficult. Which perhaps is why I still feel an incredible amount of shame when it comes to self-pleasure. Once, when Chris was traveling for work, Alice and Janny and I were talking on the set of Mom. "Chris is gone and I haven't masturbated in 4 months," I told her. "I don't know what's wrong with me. I think I probably should, but I can't." Allison just looked at me and said, "Oh, honey, you've got to work on that." Needless to say, I've got a complicated relationship with masturbation. I think we can all agree that men don't find themselves in that predicament. For a lot of women, the 4 years of college are a time of sexual experimentation, and in some ways, I definitely wanted that experience for myself. I loved going to frat parties and flirting with boys, but then I would get wasted and run away as fast as I could. I felt like the definition of a cock tease. There were definitely a few times when it got a little scary, most notably during my sophomore year. I was talking with a guy at a party when I told him I had to pee. He said I could use one of the bathrooms upstairs. In fact, he had a private one in his room. How convenient! He said he'd show me the way and went into the bathroom with me, locked the door behind him, and started trying to make out with me. "This is not fucking happening," I said. Maybe I didn't use those exact words, but close. So he left and locked the door from the outside. I was stuck in the bathroom and could hear him in the hallway talking to his friends, saying something like, "I got this, it's all good." I turned into that mother who can suddenly lift a car when her baby is trapped underneath. I heard this guy with his friends and just thought, "I'm a warrior and I'm getting the fuck out of here." So I picked the lock, which was not especially hard. It's not like I'm a champion lock picker. And I made my escape. These days, there's a lot of talk about college sexual assault, but that conversation was not happening in 1995. It was just, you get drunk at a frat house and it's up to you. So I channeled my inner ninja and dealt with it. I have had one-night stand in my life. After Chad Burke, I dated a guy named Dave on and off for most of my college career. During one of the off periods, I had a drunk night with some guys who lived on the floor above me in my dorm. We were all drinking and laughing about something stupid in the room, and I saw one of the guys look over to his roommate and give him a head jerk that clearly said, "Time to leave, wingman." You know when you're wasted, but then something happens that jolts you back to reality? That head nod did the trick. The roommate understood the signal and left, and the other guy and I started kissing. Suddenly, he was on top of me, and I said no, and he stopped, groaning, "Oh, fuck," mostly to himself, in a clearly frustrated tone. I didn't want to annoy him or be a tease, so I gave in. I was pretty resigned and unsure, but I said okay. I gave consent. Still, it's not a good memory. I was so disappointed in myself for conceding, and despite having spent plenty of time wishing I was more sexually daring, that wasn't a great night. It wasn't all sexual nightmares, of course. There were good times, too, though the best of those came later, about a decade later, but they came. Listener advice. I was the short girl. What were you? I grew up in a tall family. My mom is 5'7", and my brother is 6'4", and my dad's side is all very tall, too. I even have a female cousin who is 6'1", but I was always the little one. At home, in school, in theater, everywhere. This is perhaps most apparent in elementary school class photos, where I am always relegated to the end of the front row, about a foot shorter than everyone else. I was young for my grade. I started kindergarten when I was 4, so that may have contributed. But the height discrepancy was more than just an age thing. By 4th grade, my parents considered sending me to a growth specialist where I would be injected with hormones. They decided against it, and around junior year of high school, I finally started growing. Today, I'm 5'4". Not tall, certainly, but fairly average. Still, as a kid, being the short girl became my identity. It made me into a little Napoleon. I was insecure at school, and I covered that up by being loud and bossy at home. It didn't help that I felt like I lived in the shadow of my older brother, Bob, who I couldn't stand. Today, I adore him. He is a professor of sociology at UC Davis who specializes in bullying and has worked with Anderson Cooper to raise awareness about what it's like to be a teenager in today's world. But back then, when the two of us were teenagers, we hated each other. He was a big, tough guy, and I was a tiny short girl, and he generally overpowered me. I had all of 2 victories over Bob when we were kids. The first was during a snow day. We rarely got snow days in Edmonds because the city is close to the water, so it doesn't snow much. Always rain, never snow. One day, when school actually did get canceled due to the weather, we were out in the driveway and he threw a snowball at me that landed smack in the middle of my face. So I reacted quickly and threw one right back at him and nailed him right in the nose. I couldn't believe it. It was the first time I showed any hand-eye coordination in my life. The shock on his face was priceless. Of course, then he ran at me and grabbed me by the neck and shoved my face in the snow, but I was still euphoric. What a victory! The short girl had won! My brother is 3 years older than I am. I spent a lot of my childhood running around the house yelling, "I hate Bob so much. I hate him, Mom." And she would give me the classic, "One day you guys will get along." And I hated her, too, for saying that. I seriously couldn't imagine us ever being friends, but now we are, incredibly. Maybe sometimes Mom does know best. There was one time growing up when my brother was not the worst. I'll never forget it. I was in 8th grade and Kate, my neighbor, was one of my best friends. Most of my guy friends at the time were only friends with me because they wanted to get close to her. You'd think I would have resented that fact, or at the very least, that it would have offended my proud 14-year-old sensibilities, but mostly I loved it because it was attention, and even better, attention from boys. One day, Kate found out that some lame dude we knew said I was homely behind my back. I told Bob, and he called this guy and said something to the effect of, "I'm going to fucking kick your fucking ass. I'm going to kill you." He scared the shit out of this guy, and Kate and I were listening in on the other phone. This was back in the days of landlines, when it was far easier to eavesdrop, and I couldn't believe my brother came to my rescue like that. He loved me. He was very sweet. But apart from that, we didn't have much communication until I was older when we were both living in California. Now we're very close. Anyway, being the short girl totally infiltrated my psyche, not just because everyone in my life was tall, but because being small led me to feel like I wasn't respected or heard. And those feelings were a huge part of my life as a kid. They defined a lot about me in terms of how I related to friends and boys. And I think that sentiment was one of the main contributors to what I call my proud and angry phase, which I think was an attempt to overcompensate for my small stature. Since all that, I've become a little bit obsessed with that one word adjective that people use to describe you when you're young. You've had that experience, haven't you, dear listener? It's not just me, is it? I've always wanted to explore that question. Can other people relate to that simple identifying adjective, or am I crazy? Have you been described as the rebel or the Asian or the goody-goody? One of the biggest rewards of doing a podcast has been learning that all the weird shit we go through, other people have been there too. More often than not, those defining experiences that can make us feel weird or lonely or embarrassed are actually universal. So I decided to pull my listeners to hear their stories, but also to find out if other people have let these childhood labels define them like I did, and to learn how they overcame it. What resulted was an overwhelming chorus of stories that reminded me that we're all in this together and that being a kid can be fucking hard. Here's a sampling of the amazing responses, all of which gave me comfort in the knowledge that we've all been there. This is from Christina. Growing up, I never knew what to do in awkward or sad situations, so I'd just make a goofy face or tell a bad joke to ease the tension. Everyone would laugh and things would go back to normal, which made me happy. But whenever I was introduced to people, my friends would say, "This is Christina. She's the goofy one of the group." Being labeled goofy as you're growing up and trying to figure out who you are as a woman and how you relate to men was like climbing a mountain. I didn't want guys to see me as goofy. I wanted them to see me as sexy or intelligent or able to lift heavy boxes, anything except the goofy girl. For a long time, it made me believe that I didn't deserve love, and I would be forever relegated to the best friend role, the main character's sidekick who helped set up everyone except herself. As I got older, though, I realized that I want to enjoy life as much as possible with as much humor as I can. And that means I want to find someone who is just as goofy as me to laugh my way through life with. Now I shout off the rooftops, "I am goofy, and I'm damn proud of it." This is from Catherine. I was the weird cat girl. At my first boy-girl party, a gaggle of us went for a moonlit walk. One of the boys brought a BB gun and was going to shoot a cat with it, just for fun. Horrified, I picked up the cat and refused to put it down until we got back to the house, where the gun would be put away. That night was the end of any hope I had for being popular ever again. That, and I accidentally wore a sweater to school the same year that my cat had peed on. This is from Tara. I was definitely the goody-goody growing up. Some of that was based on my actions, but most of it was that I was quiet and shy and studious, and people perceived that as being a goody-two-shoes. Even now at 25, I have a hard time shaking that image. Anytime I do anything that doesn't fit that image, people claim it's so not like me, even though it's who I've been the whole time. I'm studying human sexuality, I have 2 tattoos, and I started occasionally doing live storytelling events. All of these choices have been met with shock and awe from the people who claim to know me best, but who can't see past that label from my childhood. This is from Jenny. I was the only female redhead in my grade in elementary school, and to make matters worse, my hair was approximately 5 times the size of my head. So I was known as the redhead or puffball because of my puffy hair. As I got older, the names got worse. In 1st grade, kids said I couldn't sit with them because I had red hair. In 6th grade, a kindergartner told me my hair made me scary. By the time I got to high school, I was ginger and fire crotch. People couldn't see past the hair. I begged my parents to let me dye it, but they wouldn't. I never had a real relationship in high school or college. People would tell me I was too different to ever find love or that I was pretty for a redhead. Today, I'm extremely grateful my parents didn't let me change my hair color. I still tend to straighten it. out of the fear that it will look too thick and puffy if I don't, but I like being different now. This is from Vanessa. I was always known as the oldest. I'm older than my brother, so I always took care of him. To this day, I feel the need to treat him like a baby, and we are in our 30s. I'm also the oldest grandchild, so that left me always having to babysit my cousins, always being the responsible one, always having to set the example. It's still hard for me to cry or show any type of vulnerability because I always have to be the strong one. This is from Siobhan. I was the quiet one. I actually became increasingly shy as I grew up because that's what I was told I was. It was difficult to get over it, but now I'm able to talk to strangers and make eye contact without turning bright red. I was always quiet, but a lot of the time I was just observing what was going on around me. I'm still observant, but I no longer see it as a bad thing. I learn things about people, and I actually listen to what they have to say. This is from Maddie. The best friend, as in, the person all the dudes confide in about wanting to date your friends, but never you. It has persisted through adult life and stopped only in the last few years. I'm 28. After a while, it's hard not to see yourself as the one people confide in rather than the object of their affection. It's a ridiculous trope that, unfortunately, was so true for me from ages 13 to 25. The lesson here? Screw the labels. But also, there's power in sharing our stories. Also, did I mention that you guys are awesome? Proud and angry. In August 2016, Patty Stanger, the millionaire matchmaker herself, appeared on an episode of Anna Faris's Unqualified and told a female caller that to attract a man at a bar, she should simply smile and signal. No approaching a man, Patty said, not even to ask the time or the score of the game. It was an eye-opening strategy for me, since for a long time, my approach was pretty much the opposite of smile and signal. Instead, I called it proud and angry. For a long time, I had incredibly low expectations of men, and I felt so smug every time a guy proved me right. I loved manipulating them into doing something to show that they were as shitty as I thought they were. It started in college. In the 90s, the University of Washington had about 40 Greek houses, and for whatever reason, or for a very specific reason named Chad Burke, I wanted to lash out at them, and so I would crash their frat parties. It was my freshman year, but I looked quite young. As the daughter of a sociologist, my dad was a professor before joining the advertising world, the concept of field studies was a familiar and enticing one. So I decided to conduct them at the fraternities. I played this really fucked up game where I would crash their parties wearing tiny Catholic schoolgirl skirts and raver boots with garter belts and stockings and little crop tops. When I walked into the fraternities, I was clearly not a sorority girl. There was this rhythm I found. The guys would talk to me briefly and then say, "Do you want a tour of the house?" Which I learned meant, "Do you want to go to my bedroom?" They barely talked to me before inviting me for the tour. I was in such an angry place that I love the idea of guys validating what I already thought I knew. Men don't want to get to know anybody. They just want to take advantage of women. And they almost always did. I wouldn't actually cash in on the bedroom invite. I just used it as proof that guys were as scummy as I thought they were. Then I started creating this charade where I pretend to be a 14-year-old high school student whose sister, Megan, was a tryout. Megan was at the party, I'd say, but nowhere to be found. The test, as I saw it, was simple. Is this guy going to try to fuck a 14-year-old? The answer was always yes. Though, I should clarify that I probably didn't actually look 14, and I was probably sort of known because I went to school there and had hung out at fraternities before, and I was playing a very flirtatious 14-year-old. So in defense of the fraternity guys at UW who aren't scum, which is probably most of them, I should point out that perhaps they weren't all perfectly willing to screw a 14-year-old and commit statutory rape. It was not a very scientific experiment. I'm not entirely sure why I was so proud and angry. I think part of it was just being a college kid who didn't realize that it was okay to admit ignorance about something. There was so much I didn't know and hadn't experienced, and instead of owning up to that, I thought behaving like a confident cynic would fool people into thinking I had everything figured out. But the facade also came from what I imagine was a very common goal of reinventing yourself when you get to college. Once I got to UW, I jumped at the chance to shed my theater nerd stature from high school. I did that by dressing unbelievably inappropriately. I'd wear the same plaid skirts and garter belts that I wore to the frat parties around campus. My brother, who was a senior when I was a freshman, once spotted me smoking a cigarette and dressed like I was going to a rave and marched over to me and said, "What the fuck are you doing?" He was appalled. That was when he was engaged to his first wife and about to graduate and was a brilliant academic. You know how in some families the siblings flip-flop who is the favorite and who is the black sheep? At that stage, I was the bad kid and he was the star. We traded roles for a while, but finally, at 40 and 43, we're on equal footing. He's a professor who helps prevent the bullying of young kids. I cameo as coked-up versions of myself in films named for cats. My proud and angry bit inspired other weird practices that, looking back, are even more bizarre than I realized. For example, for a long time in college, I loved doing this strange card trick that was basically an inside joke with myself. I would ask people to draw a card, and I'd explain that I was actually a card reader and could tell them their destiny. No matter what card they drew, I would say the same thing. "Oh, you drew the Jack of Diamonds, or Nine of Spades, or whatever. That means you are really creative. You have some obstacles ahead of you because you don't know how to achieve the leadership role you're destined for." Just the idea that I could say the same thing to every person and they'd always be like, "Oh my God, that's so true," made me feel superior. In retrospect, it's odd and disturbing that I took such pleasure in people living up to my low expectations of them, but it served as confirmation that my loneliness, because I didn't have a ton of close friends, was warranted. This is why I'm lonely, I think. These people are minions. When truthfully, other people's intelligence had nothing to do with why I didn't have a close circle of friends. It was that I was shut off and relished my loneliness, and I baited people to give me what I was looking for. There was also this game I played when I studied abroad in Italy, in which I would jumble up English words to test Italian men. So if I was talking to an Italian guy who was fluent in English, I would say power feeling instead of power trip, for example. The test was, is this guy going to pretend to understand me? It was weird, especially since I was basically just mocking someone's admirable attempt at speaking another language. I don't know where I got that from, or why I wanted people to let me down. I think there was an element of guarding myself against rejection. You are going to disappoint me, so I have to reject you first. Maybe I played up the proud and angry persona because I was always attracted to those same qualities in men. I don't know why. I didn't date much, but there were maybe one or two nice guys I went on a couple of dates with who I remember not being interested in. It had nothing to do with their level of attractiveness. I just wanted an asshole. I don't know why women are always attracted to bad guys. Even after being one of those women, I still don't get it. In my case, I was partially drawn to that kind of person because I was a late bloomer and I didn't feel very attractive. So anytime someone remotely good-looking glanced my way, I fell hard for him. And I think asshole guys can sense that and take advantage of it. But I shouldn't tie that to gender. Guys fall all the time for women who are perhaps not the most stimulating other than their physicality, and it's the same thing. A person is willing to put up with a lot when they're just so grateful for the attention. I don't know when the shift happens to realizing, oh yeah, I actually like being with someone who is interesting or makes me laugh or makes me feel good, or at least someone who doesn't belittle me or make me feel bad. I certainly don't think all my exes intentionally wanted me to feel shitty. I just think that was part of the narcissistic type that I was really drawn to. Basically, I spent way too long subscribing to the proud and angry approach, the trappings of a youthful, immature person. I should have just smiled and signaled. Turning the tables, not so rapid fire. Since we started the Unqualified podcast, our guests have been good sports when it comes to the recurring segments, which can be silly and sometimes kind of wild. But we've never turned the tables. I have never been on the receiving end of not so rapid fire or how would you proceed or deal breakers. So I decided to put myself in the hot seat for this book. I asked my friend Cassie Daniels, a screenwriter and segment producer on the podcast, to put together some questions and surprise me with the classic unqualified treatment, and it made me weirdly nervous. It's odd to be on the opposite end. I feel like I need to call all our guests and apologize. Not so rapid fire with Anna Faris. Would you rather lose your orgasm or your sense of humor? My orgasm. It would be sad, though, and the two are kind of linked, aren't they? If you're in a happy place and relaxed and really love your partner, it's so much easier to have an orgasm. And I can't be in a relaxed, happy place with someone who doesn't make me laugh. But if the two were completely separate, then yes, definitely the orgasm. What's your survival plan for a zombie apocalypse? I've actually been told that I should head immediately to the West Side Ace Hardware because the whole building is surrounded by high, curved metal fences that the zombies can't get into, and we would have plenty of supplies like shovels. It was the Ewan twins, who worked on Observe and Report and have written a zombie film themselves, who told me that. Well, what can I bring? I asked. We're not even quite sure we're going to let you in yet, actually, they said, because you aren't going to offer a lot. What if I offered comedic monologues to keep the morale high? Well, you'd still be taking our water supply, they said. So I offered to help procreate, but they were iffy on that, too. So I guess if they didn't let me in, I'd stay at my house and I'd let people come over. I've got a nice candelabra and some weaponry to smash a zombie's brains in and lots of earthquake survival kits that my mom gives me every Christmas. Think of this like fuck, marry, kill. But instead, you have to hide a dead body with someone, call them to bail you out of jail, or get anal bleaching together. And it's the co-star edition. Here are your options. Allison Janney, Regina Hall, Emma Stone. I think I would hide the dead body with Regina because she's pretty cool under fire. She wouldn't panic under the stress of that. I'd call Emma Stone to get out of jail because she's really crafty and quick on her feet and she would create a plan. I think she'd be a little surprised to hear from me, though, because it's been a while. Hey, Emma, I'm in a little jam. But I think she would answer the call. And then Allison, yeah, we could do anal bleaching. We've seen a lot of each other's bodies. But truly, I think any of these women would perform well in any of these scenarios. If you could erase one audition from your memory, what would it be? There was an audition I did in college. I can't even remember what play it was for anymore. But it was at the ACT Theater in Seattle. And I remember working really hard to prepare and knowing from the moment I opened my mouth that they weren't into me. I did a monologue, and then I read from the script with another actor, and I knew I was tanking. I wasn't doing well in my theater classes at the time either. After the audition, I ran into an older actor outside the theater who told me that if I can do anything else, I should. Do you want to act? He asked me. I said that I thought I did. Are you good at anything else? He asked. I said that, yeah, I probably was. Then that's what you should do, he said. If it's not torment to not act, then you shouldn't act. So I thought, okay, I'm not going to act anymore. I dropped out of the drama program at UW and went into comparative literature and then Greek mythology and then communications before I finally landed on an English major. That was the audition that made me say, all signs are pointing to me not being an actor. I felt a little bit bummed about it, but the idea had been growing in me for a bit. I was practical and realistic, and I had already worked with enough struggling actors to feel confident that I wasn't just going to go to Hollywood and make money acting. So I stopped. But I had a Seattle-based agent already, so I thought, if she calls me, I'll still audition for commercial things in case I can make a little money here and there. And she did call, about a horror film that would eventually pull me back to acting. If you had a wrestling move, what would it be called and what would it be? And what would your wrestling name be? The move would be the Ferris Wheel Faredown. It would involve me being in a handstand and swiveling my legs and wrapping my ankles around my opponent's neck and taking them out head first. It would be pretty dramatic. My wrestling name would be the Ominator, like rhymes with Dominator. That doesn't make a ton of sense, but she'd be a pink dominatrix. You are serving 7 years and 4 months at a maximum security prison in Wichita. What are you in for, and what is your prison job? Easy. I'm in for using a big Bowie knife to stab and murder a home invasion burglar who ended up being unarmed. I stabbed him maybe 24 times. So the big question became, was this self-protection? Maybe it was an acquaintance or someone I knew a long time ago. So while it seemed like maybe he came to rob me, the details are a little hazy. But I thought he was trying to rob me when I stabbed him, or that was my defense at least. I would like to say that I'd work in the prison library, but I think I'm too chatty, so I think I'd want to do food service. But not dishwashing, though I'd probably have to work my way up. Or I could do laundry, but there's a lot of noise there, so I wouldn't get to be too chatty. My volunteer work would be in the theater program, the Glass Menagerie, over and over again. Sometimes I would play Laura, and sometimes I'd be the gentleman caller. This doesn't sound too bad, actually. Maybe I should stab someone 24 times to get to do this. I would excel in prison. I do like to make the best of a bad situation, and I don't like drama, so I'm not going to be starting shit. I would learn to lay low until I got theater respect. Who was the bigger gold digger, Belle or Aladdin? With Belle, I think the whole thing was about aesthetic, so I've got to go with Aladdin. But I am fascinated with successful, real-life gold diggers. They're amazing to me. You see them a lot on Real Housewives, and it's an art. How do you get elevated to marriage status? It's a big red flag when a hot young girl has been with a rich guy for 6 or 7 years and there still isn't commitment. A successful gold digger makes it happen in the first 2 years. The proposal isn't going to happen if you got too far down the road. Here's what I think it takes to get to marriage. The girl can't have slept with any of the man's friends. She has to give good blowjobs. She has to be mildly flirtatious with the guy's friends, but not too much, because the friends always have the guy's ear. She has to be very pleasant and laugh at everyone's jokes. It sounds exhausting. Would you rather eat your own placenta or be in labor for 72 hours without an epidural? For sure, eat my own placenta. I'm not thrilled about that idea, don't get me wrong, but when I was in labor before my epidural, that was like nothing I've ever known. I always thought until that day that I had a high pain tolerance. I still think I do, but labor is a whole other kind of pain. Next time, if I were to ever get pregnant again, I would know when to start asking for the drugs. You think the epidural is going to be some quick thing and that you have time before you need to ask for it, but no, it's a whole production. You need to sign consent forms and your husband has to leave the room. Contractions are a mind-numbing pain. I remember Chris complimented me, like, "Babe, you didn't even scream." And I said, "Because I couldn't. I was so consumed. I had nothing in me." I remember in the moment telling myself, "There's going to be a time where I'm going to forget this pain. Anna, do not forget. Do not forget. Do not forget. Do not forget." But then you do. Waiting. I was lucky to land a gig early enough into my time in LA that I didn't have to do the whole waiting tables while hoping for my big break thing. But that doesn't mean I haven't done my time in food service. In college, I waited tables at a high-end retirement home, not because I love spending time with the elderly or because I felt like this would be more meaningful work than serving rich finance guys. I wish I was that good of a person. It was just that the other restaurants I applied to wanted me to be a hostess first. While at Ida Culver House Broadview, I could immediately be a waitress. I figured I could wait tables for a bit, then I could leave and get a better waitress position at a fancy restaurant soon after. I got $5.25 an hour, no tips. Not until Christmas, at least. The other workers there kept telling me to just wait until Christmas. For what? Some old dude to give me 15 bucks? It was tough work. Not only is it grueling to be on your feet all day, but it's also so incredibly boring to listen to people tell you what they want to eat. Figuring out how to focus on the words coming out of people's mouths while they told me their food order was seriously my biggest challenge. Of course, it didn't help that I would go to work stoned, and I'm not a good stoner. Despite repeated references to smoking weed in this book, the activity actually makes me paranoid and weird, and that's why I don't do it anymore. Once I was taking the order of a four-top, four little German ladies in their late 80s who sat together every dinner. They placed their orders, and I said, "Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh," as I wrote everything on my pad. I always used a pad. I don't understand those servers at fancy restaurants who don't use a pad. I memorize lines for a living, but I would never be able to keep orders straight. After the last lady put in her request, I walked back to the kitchen and looked down at my pad. It was all just scribbles. I hadn't written down any actual words. I went back to the table in a sweat trying to figure out what I was going to say. If these ladies had had dementia, I would have had some hope, but no luck. They were a sharp posse. So I said something about a cook dropping their order, but it was still embarrassing, especially since there were only 4 options on the menu. Later that same week, I spilled hot coffee on one of those little German ladies. Bottom line, I lasted 4 months and didn't even make it to Christmas. I was going to school and trying to get homework done, and my glamorous waitressing days did not feel like my destiny. Plus, between bus fare and getting my uniform cleaned, I ended up losing money overall. When I told my mother I couldn't do the retirement home job anymore, she was so disappointed in me. "You are not a quitter," she said. "I did not raise a quitter." All I could say was, "Maybe you did." But I needed a job. My parents generously paid for my college, but that was it. I didn't have an allowance. Poor me. I did manage to patch together a handful of acting jobs that would cover me for a month or so at a time. Training videos, radio commercials. I did a health insurance training video for nurses and doctors in which I played a young woman who was being told she has cancer. The director was so impassioned, so intent on me finding the arc